In the 1989 editorial in Anthropology Today, I took the discipline to task by drawing an unfavourable contrast to geographers who, even at that early time, had started taking a leading role in discourses about climate change. And although shortly thereafter, of course, they were eclipsed by economists. In the past decade, however, there's been, if not an explosion, at least a blossoming of anthropological attention to climate change, as evidenced by the books that I'm using here on the title slide, and also as evidenced by last year's very successful RAI conference on anthropology, weather and climate that I helped to organise, and which attracted over 500 participants. But it seems to me that much of this work is in what I would describe, what my generation might describe as the disappearing world school of anthropology. Most of you are lucky enough not to be able to remember this wonderful Granada TV series from the 1970s, which featured a lot of leading anthropologists and the peoples that they studied. But the underlying theme of the Disappearing World TV series was the threat to these peoples from the pressures of global development, international development, economic, technological, so on and so forth. And I think the pressures, 40 years on, the theme of pressures on the livelihoods and lives of indigenous peoples is still the theme of much of this work on anthropology and climate, but now those development pressures are mediated or modulated through the idiom of climate. So we're still looking at the underlying causes of disappearing worlds, but now doing so through this climate change lens. And my interest is of something of a different sort. Since the mid-1980s, I've been looking at the variety of perceptions about weather and climate, particularly focusing on the production, use and rejection of knowledge about weather and climate. And I want to locate that first in the anthropological tradition, and an engagement that goes back at least as far as Mary Douglas's 1962 paper comparing the Lele economy and the Bouchon, in which she points out that although the Lele and the Bouchon lived on either side of the Kasai River in the then Belgian Congo and enjoyed what in meteorological terms was considered to be an identical climate, they had very different perceptions of it. So the Lele saw the summers as being a rather pleasant period, one for leisure, for drinking palm wine and getting into brawls, whereas the Bouchon regarded the summer as a hot, dry, unpleasant time of the year. And Douglas was trying to understand how people could have such a very different perception of what, at least in meteorological terms, seemed to be the identical climates. And she traced this back to differences or disparities in their bride wealth practices. Whereas the Bouchon pay their bride wealth in cattle, which, and their herds could be expanded through judicious herdsmanship, the Lele paid bride wealth in raffia cloth, which was the exclusive monopoly of old men. So in the summertime, while the Bouchon boys were out busily trying to get their cattle herds together and working hard in the hot sun, the Lele were able to relax under the trees because they weren't able to do anything that was likely to improve their marriage prospects. More recently, the American anthropologist Willett Kempton has contrasted the very different perceptions of urban Americans and rural Americans of heat waves. I don't think I need to expand on what you might imagine those to be. We have the work of the environmental historian Bill Mayer, who points out that in fact, in the 19th century in New England, hard winters were something to look forward to because it increased mobility. It froze the ground and you could move around and you could move heavy goods around much more easily on sleighs and sleds than you could in other times of the year. And then there's the example of Sarah Strauss's work, looking at weather sayings and farmers' rules, or Baumregeln in Germany since the 8th century. Ben Orlov's particularly interesting work on the way in which Andean farmers use the clarity of the Pleiades as a way of predicting that in the length of autumn, as a way of predicting that there will be an El Nino next year. And actually, it turns out that that one is meteorologically very sound, because in fact it's something to do with moisture in the upper atmosphere that actually makes the Pleiades fuzzy in the late fall. So that's a very accurate observation. So we've seen in the last few years even the emergence of these terms ethnometeorology and ethnoclimatology, and the International Network for Anthropology of Forecasting Weather and Climate was founded in this very room just under a year ago, convened by Sophie Haynes and myself. I do think we need to get a better acronym for it than NAFWAC, however. We need to work on that. So here's the outline of what I'm going to talk to you today about weather and climate in a cultural perspective. I'm going to talk about, there are three parts to the talk, essentially. One is to tell you a bit about some field work I've done on what are called forecast applications, the use of climate forecasting and weather forecasting. I'm then going to go on to explore some aspects of the culture wars around climate, the credibility of climate science and climate skepticism. And then I'm going to talk a bit about climate geoengineering and the way in which the emergence of a new technology or potential technology has started to at least begin to make cracks in the current political consensus around consensus around climate. So to begin, I need to clarify what I mean by culture. I forget which American anthropologist it was who came up with something like 160 different definitions of culture being used by anthropologists. And here I'm unashamedly placing myself in the Durkheimian tradition. I'm sorry that David Gellner is not here today to hear me disavow his claim in his lecture 2 weeks ago that Insys is a hotbed of Latourian parasites chomping at the bit to do Durkheim in. Far from that, my approach to culture is very much in the terms that Mary Douglas described it, that culture is community engaged in the joint production of meaning. She wrote a paper with the title Traditional Culture, Let's Hear No More About It. And indeed, she was wont to say very often, culture is made afresh each morning. So we're clearly dispensing here with these ideas of traditional culture and so on, looking at culture as a dynamic and emergent property of the day-to-day work of maintaining and dissolving social relations. And also the way we make sense of those relationships in the process of doing that. One can see these processes of the creation of solidarity at work historically in the evolution of national weather. There's a very nice paper by the environmental historian Jan Golinski, who illustrates how in the 18th century, clocks helped to establish a national time. Prior to the availability of reasonably priced, accurate clocks, time was highly localized, and in fact, it depended on the meridian you found yourself on. This was a process that was then completed in the 19th century with the coming of the railways and the need to harmonize times for railway timetables. So it was about a 150-200 year period. But it created a national time, which was actually part of the creation of the national identity of the modern state. And in the same way, weather has also played that role. And Golinski describes how prior to the 18th century, it was felt, it was understood that extreme weather events were manifestations of the wrath of God for the misbehavior of the populace. And in the 18th century, with the availability of instruments such as barometers, thermometers, rain gauges, and so on and so forth, gentlemen scientists, they were gentlemen, I'm afraid, and clergymen started keeping weather diaries. And in the process, developed this idea of a distinctive national British climate. And this was a climate that was moderate, temperate, that characterized by interesting diurnal variation that kept the climate interesting, not dull. And eventually, by the way, the divines then rescued God from this effort at moving climate away from being a divine force. I say this was actually a manifestation of God's particularly positive disposition towards the British people. The 19th century saw the emergence of weather forecasting, both in the UK and the US, and very much in the service of the national economic enterprises. The UK Met Office was actually founded by Admiral Fitzroy, who some of you may recognise that name. He was the captain of the Darwin's Beagle, and he actually was the founder of the Met Office and developed predictive weather forecasting specifically for British shipping interests. On the other hand, the US Weather Service had a completely different origin. It actually originated as a telegraph office, and its mission was, because weather systems in the US moved consistently from west to east, the idea was that people out west would telegraph east and tell the folks back east what's coming. They also, by the way, telegraphed agricultural price information at the same time. So we can see here how weather forecasting itself was actually part of the enterprise of building the modern nation state. So I have a particular interest in weather forecasts, and I'm now going to move into the most sort of ethnographic part of the talk. Weather Forecasts for Wimps is the title of a paper that I wrote describing some work that I did at the very end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, looking at the issue of the take-up or non-take-up of seasonal weather climate forecasts by water resource managers in the US. Now, these were new forecasts, 30, 60, 90, 180-day forecasts, which basically told you it's going to be wetter than usual, drier than usual, or it's going to be warmer or cooler over a multi-state region of the United States. Now, using the rational actor kind of model of human behavior, Homo economicus, NOAA expected farmers and water resource managers to snap these things up immediately and start using them in their management practices. And they were quite confused and upset when they were ignored, particularly in the local water area, because in fact, new environmental regulations were making it actually much harder for water utilities to open up new sources of water. And so you'd think that efficiency would be a driving value here. That turned out not to be the case. By the way, if you're wondering about the title here, it was stolen from the advertising slogan for this four-wheeler SUV here. And that, in a way, the title gives away the message of the paper, which is that, in fact, when you have large, heavy infrastructure, you don't have to worry about what the weather's doing. But how did we get there from the beginning? We went to the three field sites. These three sites were selected to reflect variability in climatic conditions, whether they were relying on rain, snowmelt, or aquifers for water sources, as well as priority uses, irrigation, drinking water, recreation, etc. We were also looking for regions in which we knew that the water managers had different kinds of experiences with using different sorts of models for things like supply and demand modelling or river basin flow modelling. So the three areas we chose were the Pacific Northwest, the Columbia River Basin, the Metropolitan Water District of Greater Los Angeles, and Metropolitan Washington, D.C., which includes the Potomac River and the Chesapeake Bay. We conducted over 100 interviews and made field visits to facilities in each of these areas. And of course, the first thing we found was that there was a mismatch, rather obvious mismatch, between the kinds of forecasts that were being produced and the kinds of decisions that the water managers themselves were making. When we asked them, why, you know, are you aware of these forecasts? They would sort of bumble a bit, and some would say yes, and some would say no. And then we say, well, if you're aware of them, why don't you use them? They said they're not reliable enough. We said, well, what would be reliable enough? They said, well, about 80%. What does that mean? And then they would fumble and stumble. Okay. So nobody could actually, although they often used the justification that the forecast wasn't reliable, they couldn't actually state what the own criteria would be for establishing the reliability. So we guessed that was sort of a portmanteau excuse or justification for the situation whereby they were neglecting this new forecast tool. But they're also on the wrong time scale. For many of them, they said that existing weather forecasts on a 1 day to 5 day scale were more than adequate for them to schedule and carry out most operational procedures, maintenance, and so on and so forth. So they were quite interested in the immediate weather forecast, or they wanted a very long-term climate forecast to think about things like planning for new infrastructure if the weather regime, the climate regime is going to shift, for example, from snowpack, from snow to rain. You're not going to be able to store your water in the snowpack on the mountain. You're going to need more rain-fed reservoirs and so on. But they weren't so interested in that timescale in the middle, which was the focus of NOAA's activity in this area. Also, they were on the wrong spatial scale. As I said, they were multi-state regions. And if you're operating a water system, you want to know what's happening in your watershed. So clearly, there was a mismatch there. And I particularly point these out because I know Elizabeth was interested in the sort of time and spatial scale kinds of dimensions in thinking about this seminar series. What we did encounter was a hierarchical culture of invisibility. When we asked these guys, how do you know you're doing a good job? They would say, when the governor of the state is not on the phone to my boss, when the ratepayers are not storming the building. By the way, that was in Los Angeles, where the water department actually has a building surrounded by a moat. So it was a particularly interesting imagery in that case. So when the, you know, and basically when I'm not in the headlines in the newspapers. The driving value for at least on the domestic water supply side, particularly, is to remain invisible. You don't want your head above the parapet. Their mission is to routinize the irregular. What they, in the way they historically have done this is by redundancy of large infrastructure. So you have multiple sources of water, you have different kinds of storage facility, and so on and so forth. There was a strong emphasis in management here on craft skills and local knowledge, which means that, in fact, long service and long-term commitment to the organization is obviously very important. Also, they found that their freedom of movement was heavily constrained by external regulation. So, for example, if you're operating any kind of a dam in the US that has any flood control function at all, the extent to which you can vary the water level is restricted by rule curves set by the US Corps of Engineers. So, in the drinking water area in particular, the biggest fear is you turn on the tap and nothing comes out. The second biggest fear is something smelly or dirty comes out. The third biggest fear is something expensive comes out. And that's a long way behind the first two. So you have this idea of invisibility, which gives you a low incentive to rely on uncertain information. And indeed, we saw this very simple payoff matrix that suggests that if you do things the way you've always done them and they come out right, you can remain invisible. If you do the way things you've always done and something goes wrong, well, you'll get some visibility for a while, but you're not going to attract too much attention. If you try something new and it goes right, nobody's going to notice, so why bother? But if you try something new and it goes pear-shaped, boy, are you in trouble. You're going to become very visible very quickly. So there was a strong disincentive there to take up new forecast information. Now, having said I am not a Latourian parasite, I am not, on the other hand, averse to borrowing a few Latourian concepts, and one of those some of you will recognise is the concept of black boxing, which we found is a very useful way of thinking about the fact that high-level decision makers in these organisations really didn't have much of a clue where the information came from in the analyses that were put in front of them to make decisions. And that was actually this asymmetry of information was reciprocal, in that the people who actually produced analysis didn't know what happened to it. So I remember talking to one particular person who was responsible for producing environmental monthly environmental reports for a major utility in California. And I said, what happens to your reports? And she just looked at me and she said, well, I give them to my boss. I said, and what's his role? Oh, he's some kind of biologist. You know, so clearly there was a fascinating compartmentalization of effort here. This enabled us, however, to make a prediction, as maybe that's unusual for anthropologists, but we tried it, and we thought that actually the chances are that if this black boxing provided a stealth route by which new recruits coming in to work in these institutions out of universities where modelling and computational analysis was much more familiar, that this may actually be a way in which they could become invisibly integrated into the decision-making of the organisation. And interestingly enough, I had the opportunity about 18 months ago, having 15 years having elapsed since the original, we originally started this work, to go back to the Pacific Northwest. Interestingly enough, I found a surprisingly high proportion of the people I'd interviewed 15 years ago still in the same jobs. So that also tells you something about the kinds of organizational cultures that we're dealing with here. And we also found, as predicted, that in fact there were younger people who had come out of university programs who had been recruited who were beginning to incorporate some of this probabilistic climate information into the models via this this black boxing procedure. We also found out, though, that NOAA, this is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, who was responsible for the producing the short-term climate forecast, had been engaged in explicit and extensive efforts of co-production. This is a term taken from STS. Basically, this consisted of getting users and scientists in the same room so that they could try to understand each other's perspectives better. So we weren't at a point where we were able to see how the tension would resolve itself, but it's fairly clear to us here that there was some kind of a tension between these two routes for trying to get the information accepted by the water resource managers. Between, on the one hand, simply routinizing it, building it into what's already a hierarchical information culture, and yet, on the other hand, this much more participatory kind of route of co-production. We also found, actually, that there was an even stronger user emphasis than in the original work on three-day forecasts and real-time monitoring, for example, stream flow, although there was increased awareness of the seasonal outlook predictions, but people said we don't use them, we're just aware that they're there. So what we're seeing here was a situation in which the science producers were really driving the efforts to get these, to develop these forecasts and to somehow find a use for them. This was not a result of demand pull. And the emphasis on real-time information is something which is also showing up in additional studies. So in 2013, I had the opportunity to spend 4 months in South Australia, where I interviewed over 100 water users, particularly focusing on grape and stone fruit growers. Very different culture from the kind of very hierarchical, invisible culture of the municipal water supplier in the US. These were much more competitive, individualist kinds of operations. And these were people who had been subject to enormous pressures during what was called the Millennium Drought in Australia. This was a decadal period of very scarce rainfall, during which there was drastic reform of water law in South Australia. And that's important because it made water into a highly tradable commodity that was able to find its way to the highest value use. And of course, these individualistic kinds of grape growers were exactly the kinds of people who were going to set out to try to put that water to the highest value use. But another consequence of the drought had been technological change. And all of these growers had moved away from other forms of irrigation to micro-drip irrigation that's controllable remotely. And in fact, they were able to control their irrigation systems through their mobile phones, even if they were off having a relaxing weekend in Sydney. And they were doing this in real time. And the information they were reliant on, because they're using micro-drip irrigation, was real-time monitoring of soil conditions. So that's what they really wanted to know. So in fact, rather than lengthening their interest in the time scale of forecasts, their time scale was shrinking to much more to real-time monitoring. They were interested in 3 to 5 day forecasts, and that was largely because if a heat wave is coming, you want to put additional water on the roots of your grapes or your fruit trees before the heat wave actually hits. But beyond that, they really have no interest in this this intermediate period of forecasting of several months. And yet, despite that, there was an enormous scientific effort in the universities, funded by the state of South Australia, to downscale climate models so that they could be applied within the state for economic purposes. Again, an indication of this disparity between the demand, the lack of demand pull, and the scientific push. I want to move on now to from sort of regional scale to the global scale, and to talk a bit about climate change. The classical definition of climate is in tension with the very idea of a global climate. The classic definition is a regional or local statistical pattern of weather. So what is the global climate? I would argue that in fact the global climate didn't exist prior to 1957. In 1957, 1958, we had something called the International Geophysical Year. This was at the height of the Cold War, and at least part of the motivation of scientists and politicians associated with the International Geophysical Year was trying to establish an international framework that crossed the Iron Curtain, in which we could develop some idea of a common set of human interests that would somehow or other help to ameliorate the tensions of the Cold War and the potential of a nuclear holocaust. It was actually during the International Geophysical Year that the American scientist Roger Revelle first proposed monitoring carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere and the setting up of the Mauna Loa Observatory, where Bill Keeling over time constructed this famous curve, which you've probably all seen at some time or another, the Keeling curve, showing the increasing concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from 1960 through to 2010 in this case. And that has been something which has frequently resorted to in terms of climate debates as the key driver for achieving emissions reductions. But I'd also argue that this whole notion of the global climate received a further impetus in 1988, 1989, with the collapse of the bipolar world order, the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, which was actually preceded in the US by a heat wave and particular attention there to climatic conditions. And there was, in that power vacuum immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of talk about whether we could use climate and the ideas of the global climate and global environment as an organising principle for the multipolar world that people at that time envisaged emerging from that. We all know what happened to the multipolar world, of course, but nevertheless, that was the case, I think, at the time. I want to just parenthetically take a moment here to relay a personal anecdote, and it emphasises something that's important, which is that in the work I'm now talking about global climate change, my role has not been so much as an ethnographer or participant observer as it was in the work on the short-term climate forecasting. I have been engaged in these debates more as an observant participant, actually engaged initially for many years in the US in generating information and ideas for the US Department of Energy for developing climate policy. And I started doing this in the mid-1980s when I was a junior researcher at the Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, and I went to the director of the lab and said, look, there's this emerging interest in climate change. It hasn't yet become high profile, but I think there's space here for a modest research effort in the area of the human dimensions of climate change and the policy issues associated with it. And he went and consulted with his advisory board, group of greybeards. I didn't have a greybeard at that time, but I do now. One of whom was a former deputy administrator for the US Environmental Protection Agency. And this guy stops me in the corridor outside my office one day and says, "Steve, I hear you're interested in climate change as a major, you know, as a public policy issue." I said, "That's right, Milt." He says, "You're wasting your time, son. Climate change is never going to be a major public policy issue." And I said, "That's interesting. Why do you say that?" And he said, "It's too far in the future. There's no easy villain to blame. And the science is too uncertain." And I thought for a moment, I said, "You're absolutely right. Those are the three reasons why climate change is going to become a major public policy issue, because it's like a Christmas tree. Each person brings their own ornament to hang on the Christmas tree. Climate change, because it has these characteristics, people will come and hang lots of other agendas onto the climate agenda. And indeed, we've seen that happening time and time again." But where are we today? We find that uncertainty, that scientific uncertainty, that third element that my interlocutor back in the mid-1980s mentioned, plays a significant role in climate policy, particularly in the US, with the rejection of climate science and the skepticism about climate science and the rejection of climate policy. So how does an anthropological and STS approach help us to understand this phenomenon and perhaps develop a more socially productive response than the kind of responses that we've had to date? So the climate skeptics emphasize the weaknesses in the global circulation models, or GCMs, which are the boundary objects around which science, technology, and policy rotate. Okay? These emerged in the 1980s and 90s. They depended very much on technological innovation in computing. If you don't have big computers, you can't do this. They consist essentially of 10-kilometer square grids all around the world, divides the world up to these, and then you have a set of complex equations for each box, grids and layers, for each box that those grids and layers produces to drive the analysis. And the kind of data inputs come from what Brian Wynn described as a heterogeneous archaeology of past climates. Data derived from things like ice cores, tree rings, parish records, even pictures of glaciers that show different levels of ice pack from those that we see today, and so on. And the critics of GCMs point not only to the heterogeneous nature of this data, but also to our poor ability, or the poor ability of modelers, to deal with things like the role of different kinds of cloud formations in the global circulation models as a justification to be very wary of acting on climate predictions, particularly where it involves interventions in the economy, such as the imposition of carbon taxes or regulation of fossil fuel use. Now, there are true believers. In 2005, Sir David King, then the government chief science advisor in the UK, said, quote, "The science of climate change is a mature subject. There's little room to criticise climate models." In 2007, Senator Al Gore, former Senator Al Gore, said, "The science is settled," a theme that was echoed by environmentalists and climatologists worldwide. Exactly what's meant by the science in this case, by the way, is not a fixed object. Sometimes it seems to be an assertion of the underlying physics of carbon dioxide forcing, plus the attribution of rising carbon dioxide levels to human activity, and not much more than that. In other cases, it gets into very strong disputes about the modelling itself. But and certainly the 2009 ClimateGate controversy, which some of you may remember, this was the so-called University of East Anglia emails issue, saw the scientific community circling the wagons around a more ambitious interpretation of the skillfulness of the models and a focus on the prospect and consequences of high climate sensitivity. So, you would have thought there would be expert rejoicing at the recent confirmation of the maturity of climate science by the chief executive of Australia's National Research Organisation, CSIRO, Larry Marshall, who said, "Our climate models are among the best in the world. Our measurements honed those models to prove climate change. That question has been answered." So you'd think the scientific community would be very pleased with this verdict. But actually it wasn't. Interestingly enough, the president of the Australian Meteorological and Oceanographic Society immediately responded, climate chart science is not solved. Most of the uncertainty is due to uncertainty about the ways to represent physical processes in climate models, particularly clouds. So what's going on here? What's going on here is that Marshall's ringing endorsement of the CSIRO's climate research was included in an announcement of significant cuts, 60 positions out of 440, to the staff of the Oceans and Atmosphere Group of the CSIRO. So here we can see basically the solidarity of the coalescing of the scientists emphasising now the uncertainty of their models, whereas previously they've been relying on assertions of certainty. But interestingly enough, Larry Marshall was not acting as a climate skeptic. What he was arguing was that in fact what we need to do is, having demonstrated the strength of our climate science and having convinced ourselves of what's going to happen, that we should move on, no longer being asked ourselves to do more climate science, but to think about what we do about climate change. How would we respond? And this really resonated for me, because some years earlier, in fact in 2001, I had been asked by the US National Academy of Sciences to provide a pre-publication review of its report on abrupt climate change. This was a report produced largely by climatologists, actually exclusively by climatologists and economists. They concluded, I thought very sagely, that abrupt climate change is a low probability, high consequence event, and therefore we cannot really do predict and provide kinds of planning for deal with it. What we need to be doing is increasing societal resilience to surprises. I thought that's pretty sensible. But then I read the recommendations. We need to put money into two lots of climate modelling, two lots of economic modelling, and two lots of data collection for the climate and economic modelling. And I thought, hang on a minute, if we're serious about the idea of building societal resilience, it's not climatologists that we want to talk to. It's people like transportation land use planners. It's a whole variety of other kinds of technical forms of expertise that would help us to figure out how society can be better prepared to deal with fairly unpredictable outcomes of climate change. So I sent my review in, and the response to the review was, in fact, to retain the recommendations and to tone down the conclusions. I thought this was a very interesting phenomenon here, what I call the perpetuation of inappropriate expertise. Other people have called it eminence-based policy rather than evidence-based policy. I rather like that idea. But once again, it demonstrates the cultural defensiveness of certain scientific communities maintaining their solidarity in the face of threats to their position, whether they come from the sceptical side or from the side of being convinced. It also, I think, illustrates the fundamental principle of the sort of neo-Durkheimian approach, that engaging in any form of human organisation entails disorganising other people's form of organisation. And I think that's an important thing for us to keep in mind when we think about the issue of how to respond to climate change. Now, over-reliance on science is, as a source of authority has also been a factor in leading to the unreasonable expectation that climate science meets standards of precision and accuracy that are way, way beyond what we expect for other areas of either public policy or decision-making. So whilst I would argue that climate science is in fact highly incomplete, quite partial, it's not unassailable in the way that Al Gore and Sir David King were suggesting. On the other hand, I would assert that it's at least as good as the information that governments routinely use for invading Middle Eastern countries or large corporations use for new product launches. So why are we holding climate change to, or why are some people trying to hold climate change science to a very much higher standard than that which would normally be used by businesses and governments? And the answer there is, I think, that we have a cultural clash. which started right here in the US Congress. Interestingly, the idea of a climate backlash was predicted by my colleague, University of Minnesota anthropologist Luther Gerlach, as early as 1988. He said this was likely to happen. What we saw in the period of the 1980s was that congressional hearings around climate change migrated from the Science and Technology Committees in the House and Senate to the Energy Committees. And we found increasingly, if you look at the records of these hearings, that the climate scientists moved from going in initially saying, here's a problem that we see on the horizon, to saying, here's our diagnosis. And by the way, if you accept our diagnosis, here is the conclusion. And the conclusion, of course, entailed intervention in energy markets in a big way. Now, there's two things here. One is decision makers don't like being told what they need to be doing to do. And the second was the invitation, if you don't like my prescription, I've told you now how to attack how to avoid it, which is to attack my diagnosis. In a sense, the scientists gave the lead, go after the science, to the skeptics. So the prescription entailed three things that would be very difficult for American conservatives to swallow. Intervening in energy markets, international governance, and the redistribution of wealth to the developing world. And in fact, here's a lovely cartoon. This was produced, in fact, by a German organization for the German Environment Agency. You don't have to speak German to understand the body language here that would be deeply offensive to American conservatives. Here is the foreign scientist, nobly holding his head high, pronouncing on climate change, and here is the President of the United States bowing his head in contrition, taking his instructions from the foreign scientist. So where are we today? This is the result of some survey research done by Dan Kahan of the University of Yale's Cultural Cognition Project, and it shows a very direct relationship between political orientation and expression of concern about climate change. Now, I think it's highly unlikely that people figured out their position on climate change and then decided on their political orientation. So I think we have to assume that, in fact, the orientation toward climate change is in some way reflects the political orientation that people held in the first place. Now, there are those who say, well, we can understand this because the conservatives have been duped by spokesmen from ExxonMobil and other institutions. And we've had this, for example, the Oreskes and Conway book, The Manufacturing Doubt, which suggests that, in fact, climate skepticism in the US was entirely an artificial phenomenon that was deliberately generated by a campaign of disinformation. And while there's no doubt that there were interests that were pursuing such campaigns, that fails to answer why their arguments fell on such fertile ground. And it's certainly, I think, not credible to say it's because American conservatives are stupider than American liberals, or that they are more scientifically naive than American liberals. In fact, again, this was work done by Dan Kahan, if you take standard measures of science literacy and you measure the extent to which you have difference in viewpoints between those who rate climate change as a high risk or low risk, you find that disagreement increases with scientific literacy as the capacity of the those engaging in the discourse actually increases their ability to cherry pick those aspects of the science that reinforce their pre-existing viewpoint. What's interesting also is that you have, so by the way, remember please that the colours are reversed in American politics. So blue is the left and red is the right in this instance. Don't be confused by that. But I'm also interested in this black line that goes along here, which apparently isn't persuaded much either way. So it appears that there are three distinct stories that are at play here, not just simply two. So here's the first of those stories. There's a quotation here from an economist. I'm not going to read it to you. You can read it for yourselves. But I think the interesting thing is that this represents a particular viewpoint of nature and the economy. This is a viewpoint in which nature is seen as like a ball in a bowl that you can perturb and it will return to an equilibrium state, but the economy is the reverse of that. The economy is seen as being threatened by the kinds of measures that one might take in response to climate change. This was very much, by the way, the position of George Bush Jr. When he said we're not going to compromise the American way of life by spending all this money on climate change, even though it was a tiny fraction of what he was spending on the war on terror. Interestingly enough, we've all had a chance to read that now. I think it makes the case that basically this is an argument that, you know, this is where the heroes are the technological innovators and venture capitalists, the villains are panic-prone environmentalists who want to interfere in the market, and the solution, if there is a problem, let the market do its work. In contrast with this, by the way, notice what happens here. So the views of nature and views of the economy. Again, I'm not going to read this, but it's clearly an egalitarian narrative, one which extends the idea of equality not simply to other to human beings, but also to the natural world. And this is a story in which environmental degradation is symptomatic of a much wider malaise. We're losing harmony with nature, sacrificing it to the pursuit of profit and growth. Nature is fragile and the economy is forgiving. The heroes here are the outspoken climate scientists and activists who are campaigning for emissions reductions, the villains, the greedy corporations. Catastrophe is imminent, and the solution is behavioural requiring precaution and frugality. But here's the black line. And the black line is interesting, because this is a view that largely sees the problem as lack of planning and weak global governance. This is from a UN Human Development report. Here, both the global environment and the economy require monitoring and managing. Here, the idea is the ball is in a landscape within limits. But the key thing here is, how deep is this valley? How steep is the slope? Where is the ball, in fact? So it's this kind of cultural orientation that requires extensive production of assessments, such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's five-year assessments. We've been doing them for 25 years now, by the way. I bailed out after the fourth because I felt we were just producing incremental, small incremental differences in what we were doing. But here, clearly, the heroes are the scientists and civil servants and NGO representatives, building management structures for the global commons, and the villains are those complacent governments or obstructive ones who won't sign up. It's a long-term view. Rome wasn't built in a day. The solution essentially is diplomatic and regulatory. And therefore, here you don't have the same response to the scientific information as we saw, simply because you're always still puzzling about the assessment of the situation. So how do we overcome that gulf between the climate enthusiasts and the climate skeptics? And the way that has been the primary route thus far is a whole lot of social media campaigns. 97% of climate papers say that human beings are indeed causing global warming. Surely that should persuade these people who are climate skeptics that they are mistaken. It's an overwhelming consensus. Here's the problem, though. Only 6% of American scientists will own up to being Republicans. And we, generally speaking, we trust people we feel are like us. We're expressing that solidarity. And there's clearly a lack of solidarity between that's felt between people and American scientists. So it's hardly surprising that those inclined to skepticism are not responsive to the message, hey, you must be a moron, scientists all agree. And in fact, I would argue that we have got to a state of affairs which is rather redolent of Reformation theological disputes, in which the climate activists themselves are actually making matters more difficult. Because the line that they're generally taking towards the climate skeptics is, you are in a state of error. comparable to theological error. Compromise is impossible until you confess your error and say you accept the science. And when you confess your error and accept the science, you will enter a state of grace in which we can then move forward. But it's contingent upon actually saying you've changed your mind. But these positions are actually more fluid than they seem. According to a 2013 study of farmers in Mississippi and Texas, both of which are bastions of climate skepticism, 60% of them believe that there will be some change in crop mix resulting from climate change. In fact, there's much less divergence than one might expect in the behaviour of believers and disbelievers than there is from their utterances. We find the farmers across the US who will say that they don't believe in climate change are adopting no-till planting, new patterns of crop rotation, adjustment to new crops for adjustment of the growing seasons, etc. But they're adjusting to what they call the new normal. And you can have a conversation with them about the new normal, that goes fine. Mention climate change, you're in trouble. And these same farmers who praise their members of Congress for voting down funds for the National Science Foundation to research climate change got very angry when those same members of Congress voted to cut USDA funding for arid lands agriculture. So there's something very interesting going on here, and it suggests that, in fact, the cultural orientations towards climate change are not fixed in the hearts and heads of these individuals, but are actually quite labile. And are shifting from their as they move from one register to another. So they're, in other words, they're climate skeptics in church on Sunday, but when they get on their tractors on Monday, they suddenly become climate believers. Which suggests that the whole question of do you believe in climate change is not received as an inquiry about their cognitive state and understanding of the science, but is received as the question of what kind of a person are you? And the answer is, I don't believe in climate change, as I'm a conservative Republican. But there's some interesting developments, challenges to this. I may go over about 3 or 4 minutes, do you mind? I'm sorry about that, but I apologise. Because the insight that these ideas are labile raises some intriguing possibilities in the light of recent proposals to develop what are called geoengineering responses to climate change. And these could change the politics dramatically. Because we found that when we talk to hardened climate skeptics and introduce this topic to them, actually that their opposition to the science softens noticeably. And it's not just the conservative Republicans who change their tune in terms of the softening towards the idea of climate change. We also find a reaction and some fascinating rhetorical adjustments on the part of climate policy advocates. So, what is climate geoengineering? For those of you who don't know, it was defined by the Royal Society Working Group, of which I was a member in 2009, as the deliberate large-scale manipulation of the planet through environment to counteract climate change. Very briefly, there's two ways you can do either of those things. You can take carbon out of the atmosphere, or you can reflect some of the sun's light away. Okay, you can do either of those things by enhancing natural systems, adding iron to the ocean to stimulate plankton growth. Plankton draws down CO2, the plankton supposedly sinks to the bottom of the ocean. By the way, they did an experiment with this. They did get a nice plankton growth, but it was eaten by jellyfish rather than regular fish. And jellyfish have the wrong kind of poop. It floats on the surface and the carbon went straight back up instead of sinking to the bottom, as they hoped it would if it was eaten by finfish. But anyway, but the other thing is stratospheric aerosols, volcanoes. We know after Mount Pinatubo, we had about 2 years of up to 2 degrees drop in global average temperature from stratospheric aerosols. So we could do those kinds of things. Or we could go into sort of traditional engineering. We could build big machines to scrub carbon out of the atmosphere. Or we could put a big mirror or a set of small mirrors, maybe at the Lagrange point between the Earth and the Sun, to reflect the Sun's energy away. These are all, at the moment, scientific fantasies, guys, okay? These are what STS people call scientific imaginaries, but nevertheless, they are things which are beginning to be taken seriously. Now, you would think that the prospect of fast-acting, high-leverage cooling would be appealing to climate change policy advocates, to the traditional advocates of climate change policy. It's the idea of a climate emergency has been a long-standing trope of theirs, and now with sulfate aerosols, which promises to be fast-acting, high leverage. In other words, you could put them up in the air. It is suggested you could put them up in the air fairly quickly, and you'd get a very rapid and noticeable cooling effect. You would think that those would be just right to avert a climate emergency. But far from embracing the policy of the safeguard against failure, the response of advocates of strong climate policies has been unambiguous. So the Etc. group denounces geopiracy. Al Gore says it's environmental blasphemy. David Suzuki, famous Canadian ecologist, it's insane. David Attenborough described it on BBC television as fascist. And social scientists Phil McNaughton and Ron Zasinski have suggested it's fundamentally incompatible with democracy. So what's going on here? Where does this outrage come from? And I would argue that it's because traditional climate change policy has essentially been a cultural coalition between the egalitarian worldview and the hierarchical worldview, with the egalitarians wanting to mobilize the hierarchical worldview to institute political arrangements reduce emissions and to safeguard the climate. But what geoengineering raises is the possibility that the hierarchical worldview might be realigned with that competitive individualist worldview that would favor these kinds of technological interventions, leaving the egalitarian voice out of the picture. And there's some justification for that concern. Here's in the concept of the Anthropocene, which is a concept proposed by Paul Crutzen in 2002. And in 2007, it was Paul Crutzen in an article in Science and a parallel article in Climatic Change who raised the prospect of climate geoengineering in the modern era on a large scale. And in one of his articles, the one on the Anthropocene, he says this daunting task lies ahead for scientists and engineers to guide society towards environmentally sustainable management in the era of the Anthropocene. Clearly, from the egalitarian perspective, this is an obvious anathema. So, in conclusion, what have I been saying? I think I've been saying that weather and climate are cultural phenomena, and that they're differently employed in the joint production of meaning by different communities. The weather and climate are a conspicuous case of the use of nature to justify organizational and political preferences and projects by appealing to nature as leverage. I would argue that culture plays a significant role in the credibility, acceptability, and usability of climate forecasts at many levels. Whether we're talking about the organizational cultures in the case of the seasonal climate forecast for non-use, or we're talking about these larger social debates and discourses about climate policy. That climate skepticism and an expression of political cultural identity are not of individual cognitive states. It's not about what's in people's heads. And that climate science can't resolve the political and cultural conflicts that are conducted in the idiom of science. Finally, I just want to add something to that, which is about what I think the role of anthropologists is in all this. I had a recent exchange with an interlocutor in Anthropology Today who had taken me to task in an editorial I'd previously written called What Would Evans Pritchard Have Made of the 2-Degree Paris Target, which was actually about magical thinking. She took me to task for not making a strong political statement in favour of the communities of the disappearing world. And she felt that that was the role of anthropologists. I actually think that as citizens, that's fine. But what is it as an anthropologist that I can bring to these discourses that is different, that is new? And I think it's precisely not to take sides and say, my role here is as an advocate for people living above the Arctic Circle, living in the Kalahari. But my role is to facilitate discourse and ensure that multiple voices are adequately heard in public discourses and in decision-making that affects publics and in important ways. And I was very surprised, some of you will know I'm not Catholic, I'm Jewish actually, but some of you were surprised that where I derived some recent comfort from the papal encyclical on climate change. And this was the last place I expected to get a ringing endorsement for the importance of realising that solutions will not emerge from just one way of interpreting and transforming reality. Thank you.